Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, Whoopi Goldberg and Merchant Ivory films. My guest this week is Michael Bach, whose life was changed in a movie theater, or more precisely, just outside of one, when a conversation about a film he'd just seen led to a terrible discovery about the person he was currently dating. Now, 3 decades later, Michael's entire career has come to encompass a very particular set of values to which his eyes were opened that night in 1990. We'll have that conversation in a minute. Also, don't forget to head over to mattbaum.com to subscribe to my newsletter and take a look at my YouTube channel for videos about film and TV history. I just posted a video about the conflict over the sitcom Soap that engulfed America in the summer of 1977. And head over to my Patreon to support The Sewers of Paris and watch hours of bonus videos about queer pop culture, including an upcoming interview with Golden Girls producer Marsha Posner-Williams. Now, here's my conversation with Michael. Well, this week I'm speaking with Michael Bach, an author and consultant in inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility. Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Really happy to be here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It's a movie that I saw. I was probably about 20. It's called The Long Walk Home. Mm-hmm. And it starred Sissy Spacek and Whoopi Goldberg. And it was a movie about... essentially the Deep South and segregation. Why it was so impactful for me, obviously working in the field of inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility. My boyfriend at the time, because of that movie, I discovered he was a racist.
Oh.
And yeah, it was a bit of shock to my system.
Oh, geez.
We didn't last much longer after that. But it really was a seminal moment in my life where I realized that I really wanted to commit what I did to making the world a better place, particularly for people who don't look like me.
So tell me more about, first of all, like, I can't believe I've never heard of this movie because it sounds like it's got a great cast. Tell me about the film and how did you happen to come across this movie, and tell me more about the fallout.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly how I came across the movie. You know, it showed up in theaters, and I like Whoopi Goldberg and I like Sissy Spacek. And so we decided to go see it. And it was 1990. I'm not sure I actually knew what it was about when I went to see it. The gist of the story, and I'm just reading from IMDb, two women, black and white, in 1955, Montgomery, Alabama, must decide what they're going to do in response to the famous bus boycott led by Martin Luther King. And Whoopi Goldberg's character works for Sissy Spacek, and they're boycotting the buses, so she's walking to work. And Sissy actually ends up driving African-Americans around, tucked down in the back of her car, and it becomes this scandal. And she's married to Dwight Schultz. And if you don't know who that is, he played Data on... And it's also, I mean, talk about an amazing cast. Dylan Baker, Ving Rhames.
Wait, he did not play Data. That was Brent Spiner.
Oh, who the hell is Dwight Schultz then? Hold on.
Oh, he was Bart.
Oh, Howling Matt Murdock on the A-Team. There it is. I apologize. I have to apologize. All white people look alike. But yes, so Dwight Schultz, who was
different
from
nerd.
The A-Team. Different nerd. It was just... a beautiful film, really touching. I think it was probably the first time that I fully understood my privilege and my experiences. Because I was, you know, 1990, I was just barely 21 and grew up in a, I would say, relatively sheltered environment in Toronto. And I didn't kind of get the concept of racism. And I recognize how stupid that sounds, that we should understand the concepts of racism at an early age. But I grew up in a world where there was lots of diversity around me. Toronto, incredibly multicultural environment. So for me, I didn't get why you would be racist towards someone. It just made no sense. And this was probably the first time that I saw what life was like, you know, certainly in 1955 and the segregated South. And it was sort of an eye opener for me changed my perspective. And it was, I remember it distinctly. I don't know why this is so clear in my memory, but we were in the parking garage at the theater afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I was really upset because it's, you know, hard topic. And I was crying, and my boyfriend, his name is Tom, he said, I don't know what the big deal is. And that turned into a conversation.
About the Montgomery bus boycotts?
About the Montgomery bus boycotts, about racism, about slavery. And it became infinitely clear very quickly. His perspective was that, frankly, that Black people were, in fact, deserving of the treatment that they got. And I was absolutely mortified that I was with a person who shared those beliefs. We broke up very quickly after that.
I was going to say, I assume one of you walked home from the movie theater.
No, I'm too much of a princess to walk home, but still, it was sort of, okay, thanks. Got to go now.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was an amazing moment.
Gee. So, I mean, tell me about where you were, like, career-wise. Were you doing the inclusion, diversity, equity stuff that you do now? Were you doing that then?
I wasn't, because it wasn't a job. I mean, you could work for, there were nonprofit organizations that focused on things like anti-racism, women's advancement, that sort of thing. But I mean, if you could find a job in that field, it didn't pay terribly well. And so I had gone to school for IT. And so I was working in the IT space, but I did a lot of work off the side of my desk, volunteering in different spaces around working with the LGBTQ2+ communities, with newcomers or immigrant communities. But it wasn't a job until just about nearly 20 years ago now, when I started in the field. But it was always in me. Like, that was always something that was ingrained in me. So it wasn't a surprise, I think, when I actually got to do the work that I ended up jumping into the field.
In what way was it always in you?
I was raised by a couple hippies.
Okay. In Toronto, or where was that? In
Toronto, yeah. I'm born and raised in downtown Toronto. And my parents were very much 1960s hippies. My mother in particular, always raised me with an understanding that the package that I'm in, I'm white, I am outwardly able-bodied, I'm a man, that came with a lot of privilege. And I had a responsibility to use that privilege to the advantages of others. It's not that it wasn't a choice, but I don't know that it was a choice. It was just something I was destined to do in some way, shape, or form, was to be involved and to help ensure that people's lives were better in some way.
How did that work manifest?
So it started in a lot of LGBTQ2+ organizations. I'm gay. I came out in 1987, or as the youngsters like to say, the late 1900s.
What kind of an environment was that like to come out in?
It was horrible. It was really bad. Consider that we were at what we thought was the middle of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Mm-hmm. Turned out it was only the beginning. And being gay or lesbian had only been decriminalized in Canada. It was 1967, and removed from the DSM, which is the sort of holy grail of the psychological and psychiatric communities, in 1973, I think, if I remember correctly. So it was still very much a scary time to be out. There were no icons to look up to. There were no openly LGBTQ2+ politicians or actors, celebrities. We didn't have Lady Gaga or Will and Grace or Elton John. I mean, we had Elton John, but he was still dating women. Mm-hmm. And my mother, I remember distinctly when I came out to her in 1989, first of all, she was terrified for me because she thought I was going to contract HIV and die. And that's what was happening at the time. And I think it's important for listeners to understand that people were contracting the virus and they were dead within days. Mm-hmm. I knew somebody who went into the hospital, felt a little sick. He was dead the next day, and they didn't actually have his test results back. The virus at the time was far different than what it is today. It was much more virulent, and the drugs didn't exist. So she was afraid, but at the same time, she also said, you know, you need to do something to give back to the community. And so I got involved with a group at the time was called the Lesbian and Gay Youth of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I ended up being the sort of pseudo executive director of the group for a little while, and being involved in the organizing of events and activities and speakers and that sort of thing. And that moved on to working with the AIDS Committee of Toronto on the AIDS Walk. And then I moved on to the New York City. I moved to New York. So I moved on to the New York City Gay and Lesbian Anti-Violence Project, which is now just called the Anti-Violence Project. And so, you know, for 30 years, I've been involved in some way, shape, or form with different community organizations that now we call it diversity in terms of what they actually do. But it was always something I just did as a volunteer.
What was the community there? Like, as you came out and came into the community, I guess, first of all, like what prompted you to come out then?
Oh, sweetie, I was a sparkle pony at birth. It really wasn't a lot of choice in the matter. Kind of everyone had acknowledged I was gay except me. Mm-hmm. And it was in my high school years that, you know, obviously I was going through puberty. I started to show attraction to different people, you know, sort of had to come to terms with my identity. So I don't know that it was a choice necessarily, which is fine. I'm good with it. Mm-hmm. But I remember a friend's mother, this is before I came out, I was probably 15 or 16, and a friend's mother who she's kind of like Maggie Smith on Downton Abbey. She just looked at me one day and said, "Oh, darling, you're gay." And I was mortified that she would say that. And she didn't mean it as a pejorative, mm-hmm. but I had been talking about dating some girl or something. And she just sort of clocked me and said, you're not. Just mm-hmm. stop. So it wasn't that it was it had to happen. The community at the time, I think, was more inclusive and more connected than it is today, because we only had each other. A lot of people who were LGBTQ2+ had faced discrimination from family and friends as a consequence of coming out. And so we had a real camaraderie in the community. I can think about, you know, going out on a Friday or Saturday night, and the street, it's called Church Street here in Toronto, and every city sort of has its little village. It was sort of alive with people connecting, and not just sexually, but making friends and knowing that you were in a safe space was so critically important. We didn't have apps. We didn't have things to turn to. We had a community center here in Toronto. We had one in New York. I know they existed in other places as well, where it was, again, it was a safe space. I think the consequence of things like the internet has meant that the community has become more integrated into straight cisgender society, but less connected. It's sort of the curse of we got what we wanted, but are we really happy with the result?
Yeah. So then what was the work? You said you're doing a lot of volunteer work, working with the community. Was that just all like kind of free time stuff outside of what you were thinking of then as your career?
Yeah, no, this was stuff I just did as a volunteer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was sitting on boards of directors. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was organizing events, like with the AIDS Committee of Toronto. I was involved in the day committee of the AIDS Walk, meaning that I was part of the team that put the event on. With the Anti-Violence Project in New York, I actually volunteered and did their graphic design. And I, you know, I was happy to help out where I could, using my skills to help organizations with whatever they needed.
Well, how did that become more of a full-time calling for you?
Yeah, so I was working at KPMG, the accounting firm, in the IT consulting practice. I was one of a group of seven people who created the Pride at KPMG, the employee resource group for the LGBTQ2+ population and their allies. When we launched the employee resource group, great fanfare, people were thrilled. And then a couple days later, my phone rang and it was the CEO. I was, you know, young and wasn't quite clear how he got my number, thought it was the wrong number. But ended up going up and having a meeting with him. We had a great chat about it. We talked about diversity broadly, and he thanked me for my commitment and these sorts of things. And I ended up going down the hall to a friend, one of the organizers, and I said, you know, what do you think? I think we're really committed to this diversity thing, but we don't have any full-time resources to do the work. And she said, well, go talk to the head of HR. And so I did. And I said, we need full-time resources and I want the job. And they had actually at the time been thinking about hiring someone. And so she said, okay, well, go write a business case for the creation of a job. What does that look like? And partly, I think she was just trying to get rid of me. But at the same time, I went away and took a number of weeks to create a business case. And this is a very well thought out document to explain not only why the organization needed a full-time resource in diversity, but what I would do. And a month later, they gave me the job. And I haven't looked back. Truthfully, I didn't know what I was doing. I was kind of making it up as I went along. But that's also because there weren't a lot of people who had jobs in diversity. There were some, but it was a relatively new field of practice. And I sort of took all of my volunteer experience and then applied it to my employment to say, okay, well, how would I, you know, make the organization more inclusive? And I just had to put a whole bunch of pieces of experience together. Like I'd had experience in marketing and communications or in talent attraction. So then I thought, okay, well, how do I make our marketing and communications more inclusive? How do I change the talent attraction process to attract more people to the organization from different equity deserving groups like people of color, people with disabilities, that sort of thing. So put all the pieces together and sort of faked it until I made it. And I guess we were successful. I was there for in that role for 7 years and then came over and started the organization I'm in now.
Do you find, and where in that was the incident at the movie theater?
Oh, the incident in the movie theater was long before all of that. That was 1990. Mm. Okay. And I started at KPMG in 2005. So 15
years. Wow. Did you find yourself thinking about that, either that movie or just your reaction to it? Like, is that just something that stayed with you?
Oh, it lives with me all the time. I think about that film all the time. I haven't seen it in probably 30 years, but I'm a big fan of the arts. I remember long ago, I used to skip school and go to the movies near my house. And while other kids would be seeing Caddyshack and Body Humor, I was going to Merchant Ivory films. I remember, I don't know why it sticks with me. I remember skipping class to go see A Room with a View. So the arts have always played a big role in my life. And a lot of my sort of seminal moments stem from artistic moments.
Did you get in trouble for skipping school to go to the movies?
Oh, probably. I skipped a lot of school. I was a terrible student. Was it always
for movies or like, what were you?
I was never a troubled kid. Like I wasn't somebody who was smoking in the bathroom. I would go and see movies or do, it was never any, like I didn't get into trouble per se, but I still skipped class.
You said Merchant Ivory films and like, what kind of movies stick with you from that time?
Definitely A Room with a View. And this, I'm going to share quite a bit in this podcast, apparently. Why that film stuck with me so much, partly because it's just a stunning film. Like Merchant Ivory they did some amazing things film-wise, and it's amazing performances from people like Helena Bonham Carter and Maggie Smith, but also because I saw a penis for the first time on film. Mm-hmm. And I realize for some people that's kind of, you think, oh, well, of course, nudity in film. But at the time, that was, you did not see that sort of thing. I was just mesmerized. And it was really a time when I was going through my exploration of my sexuality. And I got a mad crush on Rupert Graves, who was in the movie, a young, handsome Rupert Graves. It was sort of that moment that I thought, oh, I'm very attracted to him. I don't know up until then if I had had that moment of this is your who you're attracted to. It was also, I think, impactful because it was such different film in terms of other movies that were coming out in 1985. You know, it was sophisticated and beautifully shot and sort of all of the things that you'd want, that I wanted or liked mm-hmm. from movies.
The sophistication, but also you mentioned the nudity, which you probably didn't
have. Well, there was that. I didn't mind. He was very fetching when he was young. He's still very fetching. But
did you have friends that you could share this? Like, did you tell your friends at school, like, oh, I won't be here tomorrow. I'm going to see Merchant Ivory film.
No, definitely not. I mean, first of all, I wasn't out. I didn't acknowledge or want to acknowledge that I was gay. And I also didn't want to share that. That was sort of, you know, sneaking off to the movies to see, Merchant Ivory film was kind of my special time. I was bullied as a kid mm-hmm. quite mercilessly from a very young age, starting in kindergarten and going all the way through university. I was physically and emotionally, mentally bullied. And going to the movies was a way to get lost. Yeah, just get kind of lost in this world where anything was possible. It was a safe place for me. So I didn't necessarily want to share that with anyone.
Yeah, well, so having been in Toronto pretty much that whole time, are you still there?
I'm back here. I've lived all over the place. I've lived in mm-hmm. New York and San Francisco and London, but I am back in Toronto.
How have you seen the queer community change over the decades?
It's, you know, it's very different. And I wrote about this a number of years ago. It's the death of the watering hole. People who are LGBTQ2+, in my generation, we needed bars. We needed the clubs because they were the safe place. They were a place that we could go and be ourselves. As we have evolved, as things like marriage equality have occurred and protections under laws, the need for those spaces that were predominantly or exclusively queer has changed. And I see that in the Church Street Village here in Toronto, that establishments are dying. They're struggling to stay alive because as a queer person, you can really go anywhere and feel safe. There are still scads of homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia, don't get me wrong, but it's certainly not what it was in my time. And the community has evolved and matured. And, you know, we don't need to be segregated into our own, you know, space, like a boys' town in Chicago or the West Village or Chelsea in New York. Or we have spaces all over the place, and certainly the city of Toronto has evolved dramatically and the community along with it.
So obviously it's a great thing that queer people aren't as jeopardized as they used to be. Mm-hmm. But also the loss of those community spaces is kind of a bummer. Like, have you seen, I don't know, good alternatives? Like, you know, it, certainly we don't want to go back to the bad old days of needing to clump together for safety. But are there, I don't know, productive ways for folks to clump together because they like to rather than because they need to for survival?
Well, I think those things are still happening. The question is, where are they happening? Keeping in mind that there are some members of the communities who themselves are not safe. I'm thinking mm-hmm. about trans folks. I'm thinking about people of color. I'm thinking about trans folks of color. So there is still need for some semblance of community. I think it's still out there. But I think people are finding their own spaces in bars and restaurants that are not exclusively queer, but that are known to be spaces where homophobia, biphobia, and transphobia are not going to be tolerated. It's more of that integration, that assimilation. There are absolutely still spaces where we are not necessarily welcome. My husband and I just recently, we were down in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We had to go down to Fort Wayne. And we were only there overnight, but quite honestly, the whole time we were there, we were not sure if we were able to hold hands, if we were going, like, were we going to get gay bashed? Were we going to be assaulted? You know, we were going to look at a car, and the person who had the classic car, it's not like I was going down to see a Toyota Tercel, but anyway, the person who was selling the car, we didn't know how he was going to react. So we agreed that we wouldn't sort of acknowledge our relationship in front of him because we weren't sure what we'd get. And that's the lived reality of queer people every day. We are taking a bit of a leap of faith in the spaces we're in as to whether or not we are going to be safe. So my point being that I still see the need for communities, for those locations where people can congregate. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, cisgendered and straight or a member of the communities, we still need those spaces because it is not a homophobia-free world.
So where have you encountered communities that, you know, needed help with diversity and inclusion? Maybe people didn't feel as welcome as they could be. Where have you encountered that as a problem, and what have you done to try to resolve it?
So I see it a lot. Whereas, you know, 30 years ago, any member of the LGBTQ2+ communities would face homophobia, biphobia, transphobia. There are still members that are facing that, even though someone like me is not, because I'm white and I'm cisgender. But to use a reference that isn't LGBTQ2+ specific, I think about the work I've done with newcomers, with immigrants, where I have spent a lot of time working with immigrants on not necessarily helping them acclimatize to either Canada or the United States, but helping ensure that the space that they are in is inclusive. So a lot of that is around things like credential recognition. Where did you go to school, and what is your experience? And do people recognize the value of that? Because newcomers notoriously have a difficult time finding jobs in their chosen profession. So I've been very public speaking out about how important it is to include newcomers, to recognize their experience. I'll give you an example. I was speaking at an event once, and a question was raised about accents and about getting rid of your accent. And someone stood up who was from South Africa. He was actually one of the speakers. And he said, yes, absolutely, you should get some coaching, you know, do everything to get rid of your accent. I very quickly, as I'm apt to do, stood up and said, hold on, I have to object to this. I disagree entirely, and here's why. We all have an accent. Every single person who speaks any language speaks with some form of accent. It just happens that I speak English with a sort of North American accent because it is my first language. But there are all sorts of accents with English speakers. If you're from South Africa, Ireland, England, Scotland, large parts of the South in the United States, Newfoundland and Labrador here in Canada. English is still your first language. It's just a different accent. The question is not, do you have an accent? The question is, do you understand and comprehend English? And are you able to then speak and write in English? And the vast majority are. My point being that that was one of those moments when I got up on my soapbox and said, no, this is wrong. This is not about speaking like me so that you can fit in. It's about being who you are. And we as Canadians and Americans are better for that because you bring your innovation. So this is what I do every day. It's what I've done every day now for over 15 years, almost 20 years, is to help ensure that people can bring their whole self to work. Whatever that looks like, bring it to work, be yourself, contribute to our larger society, because we're all better for it.
That remark about the getting rid of an accent seems like a kind of a little micro version of the boyfriend who is like, what's the big deal with the Montgomery bus boycotts? Like, it's such a, I don't know, hostile, I guess, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely a microaggression. And it also keeps us in the place where the quote unquote majority is the more important. So it's like the term BIPOC, which if you don't know it, it stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. Terms like that continue to keep us in the space that not being a person of color or Indigenous is the better. And these are microaggressions. They're really holding us back as a society. And in his moment, he was teaching people to be ashamed of who they were. And I don't think anyone should be ashamed of who they are. I don't think that is it's not a lesson I want to teach anybody. I want people to really embrace who they are.
So looking at the media that we have today, like you said that, you know, way back in the 80s when you were, you know, coming out and figuring out how you wanted to identify, there were not a lot of role models, particularly positive role models. What do you look at now? Like, do you see examples of not just of the kind of person that you want to identify with in movies and TV, but the sorts of communities that you think are a good reflection of what the queer community is at its best?
I think so. I think it's certainly gotten a lot better. Queer people are less of the punchline now. Like, for so long, we were the punchline. I think about one of the most, you know, iconic queer characters on television was the character that Billy Crystal played in the TV show Soap, which was a sitcom from the 1970s and 1980s. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of where he got his start, and his character was gay. But his character was completely sexless. You know, he was a punchline. Over the course of decades of television and film, we have seen queer characters being victims, psychopaths, and punchlines. And we are now starting to see them as romantic leads and main characters. They're not a subtext. They're not a subculture. They're part of the main culture. They're embraced. I was watching last night on Netflix, and I'm not going to remember the show's name. That's terrible. Enchanted? Unenchanted?
Oh, Disenchanted? Is that the
Disenchanted.
One?
Disenchanted. I think it's on Netflix, I think. Mm-hmm. And I love, Disenchantment. I love animation. The lead character, Tia Beanie, she is in love with a mermaid, a female mermaid. Her father and she have a moment, and it's just this like beautiful thing. There's no, you know, big deal about, oh, well, but it's a woman. And no, it's great. Okay. Fantastic. Just be happy. So we're getting better, just as we're getting better with representation of people of color, people with disabilities. It's getting better. It's not perfect. There's still, again, a sort of default of straight, white, and able-bodied. but it is certainly getting a lot better.
Comparing to the experience you had at that movie theater so many years ago, I guess, do you find yourself in the company of people who appreciate the importance of diversity and are not likely to ask what's the big deal?
Oh, absolutely. My circle of friends, my beyond my colleagues, beyond people I know through work, my circle of friends is, I don't think there's a single one amongst them that would ask that question. They are an inclusive bunch. It's not to say that we've all drunk the Kool-Aid and we don't have challenging conversations. That happens. Mm-hmm. But I like a challenging conversation. I want to think differently. I want difference of perspectives. But the one of the differences now, when I look across my friend group, it's also incredibly diverse, just as it was then. In fact, most of my friends back in 1990 were Black, not because I sought that out. It just seemed the group that I was most comfortable with. And it is the same now. I also think people have woken up. There's a lot like that, you know, infamously, the March 25th, 2020, when George Floyd was murdered, a whole lot of people saw that and realized that racism is a nasty reality, and we can't turn a blind eye to it anymore. So I think so much has changed in the past 30 years that it's getting harder and harder to find people who hold those racist, sexist, homophobic beliefs. They're still out there, but there's a lot less of them now.
So tell me about the new book that you've got.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. It's my second book. It's called Alphabet Soup, The Essential Guide to LGBTQ2+ Inclusion at Work. And it is a guide, a how-to on creating inclusive spaces for LGBTQ2+ people. And it is intended not just about workplaces, but around any space, whether that's a hospital, a college or university, a community center, a church, about creating and making sure that that space is one that is inclusive. Keeping in mind that a lot of LGBTQ2+ people are the invisible minority. If I'm walking down the street, you can't necessarily tell that I'm gay. You can't tell that I'm gender nonconforming. So it's important to make sure you create that space in advance. Because if I said to a lot of people, you know, you need to create inclusive spaces, they might say, well, yeah, but we don't have any gay people here. We don't have any lesbians here or trans folks here or whatever. The chances are good you do. They just don't see what they need to see in order to come out. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a book to educate people on what it all means. You know, I keep saying this, LGBTQ2+, what does that mean? What do those words mean? Letters represent, and what do that words mean? I wrote a book to really speak to anybody that doesn't understand it and anybody who wants to create those inclusive spaces.
Great. Well, so where can people find it, and when can folks look forward to seeing it out on shelves?
Yeah. So it comes out March 29th, 4 weeks tomorrow, not that I'm counting. Mm-hmm. And people can go, the easiest thing, you can search it online, but you can go to alphabetsoup.lgbt. And that'll include a list of places that you can check it out.
Fantastic. Well, Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Michael for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbound to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbound and my newsletter at mattbound.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.